take, you can take, just, we don't need to take the roll, but it's, just note the people who are here. I'm going to start out with, we got some new staff here today, starting with our new legislative assistant. Do you want to introduce yourself, Mick?
Of course. Hi, everyone. My name is Mick. I'll be the legislative assistant for this committee, and feel free to reach out if you have any questions. Thank you.
And I understand we have a new House researcher for the Republican side, GOP. Do you want to introduce yourself? And
sure. Lori Cousineau, GOP researcher.
And our House analyst is back. Marta's back from last year, and so from her maternity leave. So, and with that, we have a page. Florence? And I don't know if she's going to be our permanent page or not, but welcome to the committee. With that, we've got minutes to approve, and Representative Berg, I got to get back in the swing of things here too. You want to approve the minutes? I'll make a motion for the minutes from the April 27th meeting.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the minutes of the April 27th meeting.
2023. I'll note that. Yes. Any questions on the minutes or corrections? No, I see no one. All those in favor of approving the minutes from the April 27th, 2023, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Members, the first bill we have on our agenda today is Representative Moeller. And this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. I'll move the bill, House File 3516, and I understand we have an amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair and members. I believe it is the A1 amendment.
I'll move the A1 amendment, and if you want to explain what that does.
Yes, this was, thank you, Mr. Chair. This was feedback that we received from the Commissioner of DLI. Because of this, the drug testing we're doing, they don't have the expertise to be able to approve these tests or not, so that's why we're removing them from the bill.
Any questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment adopted. Welcome to the committee, Chair Moeller, and if you want to explain your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, it is an honor to be here. I don't often have bills that come before your committee, so this is fun for me. And also, what makes this even better for me is that this is a constituent-led bill. And you will hear from my constituent here in a little bit, but basically he reached out to me during the interim and said that his employer wants to be able to hire people quickly. They do drug testing of these potential employees, but under current statute, people have to go off to a different location to a lab to have this drug testing. And as a result of that delay, not because people are using drugs, but just that delay, they decide to go work somewhere else. And with the workforce shortage that they're having, it means that they're not able to get their employers, but also it means that employees who would pass these tests can't get started working right away. So the meat of our bill is really, it starts at line 3.14. Everything else is just to make it consistent with that, where it's allowing for these quick tests to be done pre-employment, the quick test saliva test. So if somebody is offered a job, they do the test, they pass the test, they are able to start working right away. It's a win-win for the employee and the employer. If the test is either negative, or well, I guess would be positive or inconclusive, then they would have to go ahead and do that laboratory test, that other procedure. But my constituent is here and is happy to talk about this idea that he brought to my attention.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Todd Gaynor, and happy to be here. Thanks for hearing from me today. I'm here as a constituent of Representative Moeller's district, and I'm here to advocate for this policy change, which would permit the use of these rapid saliva tests. So I'm the general manager of Distribution Center for Veyer Logistics, which is the supply chain division of Office Depot. And in my 20-plus years as a hiring manager, you know, I've experienced the challenging that the current statute has on the applicants and the friction that it has within the hiring process. So because the current statute requires samples to be retained for confirmatory testing, if the applicant would prefer that at some point, it means that you have to go off-site to a clinic. And therefore, the applicant has to make these arrangements to go to the clinic on their own time and at their own transportation expense. And entry-level warehouse work that we do, a lot of these applicants do not have transportation, so that's not an easy process for them to have to go off-site and get to a lab within the lab hours. They may also have another job that they're working, which could make it difficult for them to also get to the clinic, you know, within that time window that they have to go there. So in addition to them having to deal with the transportation, this also just adds the lead time that Kelly was mentioning, that, you know, instead of getting this fast-tracked with an instant drug test, you had the whole lag time that goes into them getting to the site and then the test results coming back. So I've seen numerous cases, quite actually a decent percentage of cases where we've extended a job offer and then we don't consummate the transaction because the drug testing never gets completed and the applicant abandons kind of the job at that point. So all the effort that you went through and they went through both to meet and to agree and extend an offer and then them accept the offer, and then this kind of just becomes a friction point in that process. So my company, Veyer Logistics, has operations throughout the U.S., and in most states, the use of these rapid saliva drug tests is permitted. And so that process creates a fast track to those applicants that we extend the job offer at the end of the interview. They do the drug testing right then, and so therefore that part of the process is immediately completed. And you know, in the states where we're doing this, saliva testing has meant that over 99% of the applicants get fast-tracked and immediately pass that. And again, I just, you know, again, to reiterate that this proposal keeps in place the protections for the job applicant in the event that one of the tests comes back is inconclusive or presumptive positive. Then they would begin the process that is currently in place now. So really, this is just hopefully steering a large majority, if not 99%, away from having to go through that process, and it's there as a safety net in case it's needed if there is the test doesn't come back clear. So that's kind of the main kind of basis for why I approached Representative Moeller on this.
Thank you, Mr. Gaynor. Is there any questions of the author, Representative Mecklen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question probably for the testifier, or perhaps the bill author knows. Is there a percentage of false negatives that you're aware of?
I can only sorry.
Mr. Gaynor.
Oh, thank you. I can only speak anecdotally. I don't have concrete data that we've collected, but my peers in other distribution centers around the network says it's almost never seen. It's very rare. I was talking to my peer in Chicago, he's like, it's been a couple years since I've had an incident where that's occurred, and we're hiring on a consistent basis in our organization. So,
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It should a false negative come back, and then there was to be an on-the-job injury of some sort, who would have the liability at that point?
Mr. So. Gaynor. Oh, thank you. Again, I apologize. I'll get to the hang of that. So just to clarify, if somebody had a positive, whether false or not, you are still in the process of the contingent job offer. And so at that point, they would go to the clinic for the full testing with the current process there, whether it's urine or whatever that testing is. So they wouldn't be working at that point yet until they've actually cleared the drug testing piece. So if I understood the question correctly.
Mr. Gaynor, I think he was asking a false negative.
Oh.
So that was, or you know, somebody yep. passed the test and then maybe later on used and then.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, not even, so if you hired them and it came back negative and it shows nothing, But then if there was to be an on-the-job accident, and then, of course, there's going to be a test now, and they test positive, would there be a liability issue, and who owns it at that point?
Mr. Gaynor.
Thank you. Yeah, at that point, I mean, once you've cleared the threshold of the pre-employment drug testing, they're just an employee at that point. So there's no look back to the original drug test to see if there was a concern. Like, that exists today, right? We could have somebody pass a drug test, have an accident, get tested, be positive. There isn't a look back to that point in time, because you all also won't know if the drug behavior is brand new or if it is, you know, has been around for a long time. So in my opinion, again, I can't legally testify in any way, but I've never seen a case where we would like look back to that original drug testing. It's one point in time at the point of pre-employment, and then it's done as far as that goes.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So somebody, if they took one of these tests and they came back negative, they would not actually start working that specific day. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Gaynor.
Thank you.
I'll
get there.
Even members who haven't been here a long time sometimes forget that. But
Thank you. So, generally speaking, you still have additional steps to, you know, in my organization, at least I can speak to. You got to create an employee number, and you got to get them set up in the system. And so usually there's a start date that you do end up agreeing on. Again, this is all part of the interview/pre-employment process, right? So the drug testing, whether it's immediate and oral, or if it's at the clinic, it's still just a technical thing that needs to get accomplished before you could start working. And so, no, we've never started anybody the exact same day that the job offer has been extended.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick other one. Do you know, and I don't know if either one of you two would know, but are these PCR tests? Are you, either one of you, are you familiar or aware what type of test? I mean, the testing policy or procedure that they're using?
Mr. Gaynor or Chair Moeller?
I'm not sure. We've used one particular brand in our organization called OralTox, and I know a lot of these things end up getting FDA approved or FDA 510 approved. So I don't know exactly what specific testing methodology they use.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm guessing to Representative Waller that's probably why you deleted some of this out, because that'll be determined. As far as what they're going to decide to use for this going forward, but
Chair Moeller.
Well, that's right. Yeah, the commissioner. They just, like they said, they aren't experts in that kind of thing. I will say the technology is really good and it's improving. I think probably when this law was written before that, I don't even know if this type of testing was even something available. But these types of tests continue to get better and better.
And Representative Mecklen, I understand that the State Patrol is testing some methods. And because there is no test out there right now, that I understand is legally they can take to court, but they're testing some of that stuff out voluntarily at the current time.
Exactly, and that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mecklen. Any further questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moeller, and your testifier as well. My question is just, when we're looking at what exists out there in the world today over the reliability and validity of these tests, can you provide some additional information? Have you brought anything else to the committee to help us in guidance as to whether we can rely upon this test as an accurate depiction of the health and well-being of a applicant?
Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the question. I don't have that. I'm happy to kind of do a little more digging and look into that. I know Mr. Gaynor has some information from OralTox, the company he mentioned, about how they do this type of testing. And he has sent me some information, too, about the federal, I can't remember what you called it, but some sort of federal approval that's done. I'm happy to provide that information as well. I don't know if Mr. Gaynor has anything more to add on that.
Mr. Gaynor.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm like an expert in the data behind it. I think that, again, seeing that 39 other states are using this currently, and some of them have absolutely no stipulations, and I think what we're here in Minnesota saying is we're still going to stipulate it to being pre-employment versus wide scale, it's prevalent in the marketplace now. It's being used by all these other states. And again, I can share that, you know, in my other markets that we're using this, we've had no concerns with it. You know, we've had almost zero of them come back where they're saying inconclusive. And especially in the absence of testing for THC now currently, we wouldn't expect to actually even see any positives with this. And we haven't in Illinois where they've been THC has not been tested for a while. So what I can say is that in the states we're doing it, it's like 99% plus are just they're passing and this box is being checked in the employment process.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate hearing that. I'm glad to hear that it's working well in other states. I also believe that, you know, we want to make our state policies reflect the sort of technology that's advancing in our world today. And so I appreciate bringing this bill forward. And I think it does, from what I'm seeing, it provides a lot of flexibility to meet our Minnesota standards. But I do think that Representative Moeller, if you can continue to provide additional details as to the reliability of the testing, I think that would be helpful for everybody involved, just so we're not heading into this. If we end up passing this bill this session or as a part of a larger bill, that we are fully aware of what we're heading into with this regard. Thank you.
And Representative Schultz, I was going to say the same thing, that if you can get us that additional information, we're laying this over for possible inclusion. So when this comes back in a bigger bill, that we can have that information and have it on the floor when the bill's going forward. And I see you're taking those notes. So any other questions? If not, thank you. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion. And thank you, Mr. Gaynor, and thank you, Chair Moeller.
Thank you very much.
Next on our agenda is overview from the Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner, and welcome to the committee and state your name for the record and please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. So first of all, thank you. I am very excited to be back. I've missed all of you. I hope everybody had a good break. All of you, I've missed all of you. So I'm here mostly to give an update on everything we've been doing at the department since we've last met, talk about the work, the implementation. Hopefully it won't be as dry as a general department overview. We're going to focus on a lot of the work we've been doing since we last saw each other. So. How do I switch, just hit this? No. Thank you. What was it? I miss everybody. All right, so I'm going to jump right in. So our dual training pipeline program is one of our work-based learning programs that we administer at the Department of Labor and Industry. And last year, three new industries were added to our dual training pipeline program, the legal cannabis industry, the childcare industry, and transportation. So just to kind of provide an update, so in 2023, we had 258 employers that were assisted through pipeline programming and activities to support their efforts. 619 dual trainees participated in grant round 11. 2,992 dual trainees participated since the program launch in 2015. So we've been able to touch a lot of different employees in different industries and helping them to advance in their careers through related instruction and on-the-job training. We have 82 occupations with industry-approved competency models, and 12 more occupations are in development, primarily focused on those three new industry areas. This program we do in coordination with the Office of Higher Education, who runs the grant-making portion of the program, and we run the competency models for the occupations and working with the industries. So really excited about all of the work that we've done in that area as we move forward. All right, next area I wanted to touch on with our implementation is Apprenticeship Minnesota. We are expanding into new industries in this area as well, looking at early childhood education apprenticeships, K-12 teacher apprenticeships, and semiconductor industry apprenticeships. So in those different areas, we are working, we have a partnership in the early childhood area with Child Care Aware of Minnesota, and that registered apprenticeship program launched in August of 2023. We have 18 apprentices enrolled in 7 child care centers across the state, so excited about expanding on that even more. For K-12 teacher apprenticeships, we're working to hopefully get to a fall of 2024 launch for the Minneapolis and Owatonna school districts and intermediate districts 916, 917, 287, and 288. So not all the way there yet, but working very closely with stakeholders, both school districts and other partners. And then the semiconductor industry apprenticeships, we have one program registered with 5 registered apprenticeships or apprentices, and 3 other companies are in the process of developing programs. All right, so just to hit on our grant making that we've been doing, we have a number of grant opportunities through the Department of Labor and Industry, and we've kind of put those all together on this slide. We have our Clean Economy Occupations Grant that was new last year, Earn Sick and Safe Time Outreach Grant, the Ergonomic Safety Grants, the LEAP Grants, or Labor Education Advancement Program, the WESA, or Women's Economic Security Act Outreach Grants, and our Youth Skills Training Grants, which is another one of our work-based learning programs. As you can see, all of these grants are currently open, other than the Youth Skills Training Grant. So if you have constituents that may be interested, businesses, community-based organizations, please direct them to our website. We've been getting good interest in all of these grant programs, and we're really excited about the partnerships that we're creating through these. All right, moving on, one of our bigger programs that we took on implementation of after last session is Earn Sick and Safe Time. So in that time since the law was passed, we had some period of time where it wasn't in effect. It went into effect on January 1. But these are just some highlights of the work that we've been doing at the Department of Labor and Industry, primarily in our Labor Standards Unit. We have handled over 3,000 email and phone inquiries from stakeholders related to Earn Sick and Safe Time. We've run a social media campaign, and those advertisements resulted in 2.5 million impressions and nearly 80,000 clicks onto the ESST website that came directly from those social media ads. Our website, and this isn't on the slide, but our website has been visited, our Earn Sick and Safe Time page has been visited more than about 397,000 times in 2023. So I'm getting good traffic there to all of the resources that we have. We've sent gov delivery bulletins, we've done public webinars, and we've also done 80 Earn Sick and Safe Time trainings around the state, in touching about over 8,000 people. So a lot of efforts. We have our next step on Earn Sick and Safe Time is to do a mailing with the assistance of Deed to every employer registered in the UI system to help inform them of the obligations. All right, oh, wrong button. Just hitting on some of our work in construction codes and licensing, we've introduced electrical remote virtual inspections in Northwest and Southwest Minnesota counties in September of 2022. And we're looking to expand that program, but this is really cool work that we're doing to help save time, but also make sure that we're doing the inspections that ensure compliance with code as well as safety. So I know I'm gonna try to go through quickly. just an update on OSHA compliance, and we appreciate the investment that the legislature made in Minnesota OSHA last session. This is just kind of a rundown of the compliance efforts that we've had within our OSHA compliance division, but really excited about all the work we've been making progress on hiring and also making sure we're getting out there and enforcing some of the new laws in that area, which is what the next slide is focusing on. So we have two new enforcement areas, both ergonomics and warehouse worker safety. We've done 11 outreach events in those areas. Enforcement for both programs is in effect. We've also developed numerous resources that are available on our website, as well as direct connection to employers that are in those industries. All right, hitting on work comp, because we don't talk about that much, because so much of the hard work is done in the Work Comp Advisory Council. But last year, the council came to agreement and increased amounts payable to injured workers with permanent impairment by approximately $30 million in increased PPD benefits that are anticipated for workers that were injured on or after October 1st of 2023. This is a big deal. It was something the parties had been working on for a long time, and really excited that got over the finish line. And I know the next bullet point doesn't sound very interesting, but cost of medical records was also a big deal to the Work Comp Advisory Council. This made some much needed changes and improvements to the work comp system. All right, and last but not least, I wanted to highlight some of the important work we've been doing at the department. Here are some headlines that have happened over the last year. To just touch on, we were given additional resources, and those resources are appreciated, and it really does impact workers as well as employers who are playing by the rules across the state. And so wanted to give some attention to the important work. Of course, we're doing a lot more work that isn't reflected in headlines that help individuals every single day, but also wanted to just give some attention to the work that has made it into the headlines. So I think that gets me to the end, but I am happy to stay for any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. Great to see you. Great to be back. Thanks to you and your team for all the work that you do. I want to start on questions here. I know there's probably many members around the table who are seeking to find out how things are doing in the enforcement of a lot of the new workplace safety related items. So I wanted to just begin, frankly, with the earned sick and safe time piece of legislation, and talk about that through the feedback that I've gotten in my community throughout central Minnesota, specifically from my schools. And I wanted to just kind of ask and seek your feedback as to how that has gone with schools. That has been something that has stuck out to me, even beyond small businesses. The biggest concern I have heard has been from my schools in my community having a hard time implementing the program, having a hard time looking at the future and the outlook there. And so I wanted to hear your feedback as to the implementation in our schools.
Commissioner Listenbach.
Chair Nelson, Representative, we've been working very closely with schools. I went and did a presentation to the Association of School Administrators when they met to walk through and spent a lot of time answering questions and trying to provide guidance. We've also added a number of specific frequently asked questions onto the website that get at some of the more challenging areas of implementation to try to provide guidance and more support in that area. I do think that they're making all of the right moves to ensure that the law is being implemented, and we've been willing to work with them to help come up with solutions to any challenges that they have found. But I think I feel like there has been a lot of communication between our labor standards unit and school districts and school district leadership throughout the state in tackling some of that. But I think we're in a good place.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the given topic, it has felt as though like their flexibility has that has been the number one thing that has hampered us, and I'm hoping that during this session we can work on some of those issues together to help encourage the flexibility that our schools need to provide the programming for our kids. Like at the end of the day, it comes back to that, and so I would just appreciate your words today. I do have other questions, but I want to make sure I go back through and let others have the opportunity. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I had a couple questions. You know, what are some of the most common questions the department has received when it comes to sick and safe time, both from employers and employees?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Nelson, Representative. You know, I don't know if I know the most common question. I think some of the questions that I know have been that I've discussed in my meetings with labor standards and the folks who are on the front lines answering the calls and answering the emails are just clarification between the different options. You know, that you can use an accrual method where you get 1 hour for every 30 hours worked. You can use a front loading option where instead of doing that, you front load 48 hours. To an employee so that it's available immediately, but then you don't have to do the accrual to get there. So I think clarification about different options and what might make sense for an employer, questions about whether if I choose this option for this employee, do I have to choose that option for every employee? So things like that, and really helping to highlight where they do have flexibility under the law, that this option must be for every employee that you have. There are employees in different situations that different methods for accrual of earned sick and safe time make sense.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Chair. Another question. Commissioner, I'm just wondering, are you getting questions from business owners requesting required disclosures be available to them? Are those available online to make sure they're in compliance with any, you know, disclosure requirements to employees?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Nelson, Representative. We do have on our website, so there is the one requirement that employers provide notice of earned sick and safe time rights. So that notice is available on our website. We had that up, I believe, in November. And that is, I think, translated into 10 different languages, but I'm trying to remember exactly. But that note, there is an example notice. Employers are not required to use the notice that we have on our website, but it is available if they choose to use that. We also have compliance checklists that we've been using as we've been receiving calls or complaints from workers who are saying my employer is not following the law with regard to earned sick and safe time. Our first step is to contact the employer and tell them, here are your responsibilities, here's a checklist that you can use, and do that information, the inform and educate aspect of the law. So we have a lot of resources, that notice, that compliance checklist, FAQs, all available on our website.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. That was important to me. It was one of the amendments that I worked on for that bill to make sure that, you know, some of these small businesses that were impacted that don't have HR departments could, you know, have that as an option that you guys are providing that. So I do appreciate it. The last question I have.
Representative Myers, go ahead.
Commissioners, you know, last time we were here, we heard a lot about the department not having the resources available to complete inspections or review complaints, and we had a few bills that passed, I feel like, because of that. And I'm wondering how, you know, the resources you've received have helped address that or maybe, you know, not addressed it fully.
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson and Representative, that is always a hard question because we appreciate at the department the resources that have been put into both labor standards and Minnesota OSHA, and we think they go a long way into ensuring that employees are receiving the rights that they're have the rights that they have in statute, and that's being realized in the workplace, as well as protecting employers who are playing by the rules. And then on the OSHA side, that people are, you know, health and safety of workers is a priority for the state. And so all of those efforts and additional resources are going a long way. Does it mean that we have enough OSHA investigators or labor standards investigators to ensure compliance in every business in the state of Minnesota? No, and we'll never be to that point. So I think it has gone a long way, but that's why we have to rely on voluntary compliance, education and outreach, and enforcement by, not enforcement, but other entities doing some of the same roles that we do, whether that's private right of action and enforcement by workers on their own. We have to rely on all of that. The system has to work as a whole in order for workers to realize the benefits that they're provided in law.
Representative Myers.
Yep, thank you for that. I want to make sure that, from the department's perspective, that those employees or those employers that aren't following the rules, that you guys are making sure that, you know, you're following up and that, you know, we don't get into a situation where employees are having to deal with issues for 18 months and 24 months, which then leads us to having to pass more bills because, you know, I think less bills are good. I'm just hopeful that with the resources that, you know, that the enforcement can be there.
Any further questions? Rick McDonald?
Mr. Chair, good to be back in your committee again. As I labored an hour drive in that treacherous snowstorm to get here, it's good to see you and be in the committee again with you in your last session. Question, Commissioner Blissenbach. A few years ago, a number of years ago, Governor Dayton, in a second biennium, decided to have the undo session. That was a fun one. We got rid of laws that didn't work and archaic language and things that just didn't work. And oftentimes, a second session, the second year, we fix things that didn't work. Like there's a big tax bill that we have to fix this year, $300 some million. Is there anything that we did here at the legislature in this committee that has been implemented or difficult to implement, or just something that you think that maybe we hit the mark on everything, we batted 1,000, or we need to fix something? We're not perfect people by any means, so just that's the question. Was there anything that we need to fix that just thought it was a good idea at the time from one of us legislators, but we missed the mark?
And Representative McDonald, I don't think we did. I think I'd be very surprised if we batted 1,000, but Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative. This will not be the last you see of me. I can promise that. No, we do have some technical things that we'll be working on that we have been putting together and will be back here, I think, before long.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. So then you agree with the chairman that we didn't quite bat 1,000 last year.
Commissioner, yeah, and I would say that we're none of us are perfect, as you said. So, Commissioner.
Chair Nelson, Representative. I think there are always things that we can improve and things that need to be fixed from a technical perspective, and we're always looking to do that.
Representative Schultz, I see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am aware that this week the quote-unquote fix to the ESST has been introduced, House File 3882. Can you explain for us, the areas that we want to quote-unquote fix this session for our unsession, as Representative McDonald led into?
Commissioner.
Chair Nelson and Representative, you're going to really tax my brain here for a bit because I don't have it in front of me, but I think that I would characterize almost everything in that bill to be technical or addressing an issue that was brought up from a constituent as we were doing implementation of the bill. So I know we'll have an opportunity to go through each of those proposed changes in this committee, and I look forward to that.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I just kind of one follow-up question based upon the back and forth with Representative Myers here. It's a little bit two-part. Where are the biggest challenges in enforcement today, as specific as you can be? And then two-part to that is it's kind of the same question, but where are the cracks in the current system?
Commissioner.
Wow. Chair Nelson, Representative, biggest challenges for enforcement. I think as we tackle as a department the harder cases where we, and I think each department within, or each division within the department would maybe answer this slightly different, whether that's OSHA, labor standards, work comp, or CCLD enforcement would probably answer this differently. But the most challenging cases take a lot of time and a lot of resources, and that means we can't take everything that comes in our door. So not being able to take every complaint that comes in is always a little heart-wrenching. I know it is for our investigators. And so I would say that that's one of the bigger areas, one of the biggest challenges. And I think that is because as the nature of work changes, new challenges that we've never seen before are presented. So when we're dealing with, in the construction industry, contractors that are on a job and then gone from a job, and we don't have any records of who was there, we don't have any earning statements that are required, any evidence of any payroll, but the work got done. It takes a long time to put that together. And so I think those are the challenges, is the amount of time it takes to rebuild something that from those employers that are the bad actors in the industry. And we don't always have the tools in law that move as quickly as the employers who are looking to undercut other employers.
Any other questions from the members? If not, thank you, Commissioner, and I hope to see. We will see you again. The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 3456, Representative Greenman.
Someone left their water bottle. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's yours. Okay.
If you want to move your bill, I understand this is going to be referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd like to move House File 3456 to be referred to Judiciary and Finance and Law.
And we have amendments, but if you want to explain the bill first, are the amendments yours or are they?
No, they're the GOP, and I'm thinking maybe we should, I should go, we should take testimony and then do the amendments. It's probably the best way to make sure we get all the testimony.
Explain the bill, and we'll take testimony and then do the amendments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. It's nice to be back here. I'm looking forward to this discussion on what I consider closing a loophole from work we did last year. This bill protects workers by prohibiting restrictive employment covenants in service contracts. It's a bill that closes a loophole that ensures Minnesota's prohibition on non-competes is not evaded in service contracts that are signed above the heads and without the knowledge or consent in many cases of workers that are being impacted. Restrictive employment agreements like non-competes and like the ones found in these service contracts that prohibit workers, hiring workers are barriers to the freedom of workers and fair market competition. They restrict workers from seeking better wages and working conditions and limit workers' growth and their career growth within an industry. We had a long conversation about this both around the non-compete bill last year and the no poach agreement bill and franchises last year. But just to remind folks, the FTC has said that these kinds of clauses deprive American workers of between $250 billion and $295 billion per year in income. Last session, we took a big step forward in protecting workers and market competition and the fair market by prohibiting employers from using non-competes and prohibiting franchisors from using no-poach agreements to restrict the job prospects of workers through employment covenants. We also, when we took on the no-poach agreements, which looks a lot like these agreements here, looked at agreements that were signed above the head between two parties of workers without their consent. We passed those bills with the clear intent of protecting Minnesota workers from practices that employers were using of putting restrictive provisions to limit the freedom of movement and opportunities for their workers. And this summer, as those bills went into effect, we learned about the practice that you could call a shadow non-compete. It's where companies include restrictive employment covenants in their service contracts that operate like a non-compete could or does. And in many cases, though, these are signed between two parties, and the worker who is impacted and limited don't even know that they're there. They obviously don't consent. They're not parties to these contracts. These restrictive employment covenants that we're talking about here today have the same impact of non-competes. They limit job prospects. They limit the opportunity for wage increases, potentially, for career growth. But I think that they're worse because in many cases, the workers don't know that they exist until they're impacted. This bill is simple if you look at it, and it's a lot like the no-poach agreement we saw we passed last year. It restricts service providers, or it says that service providers cannot restrict or prohibit a customer from hiring an employee of that service provider. You're going to hear from some testifiers today. I will let them talk about how this shows up specifically in industry. But these have real-world consequences for those workers who have seen their jobs threatened, their livelihoods put at risk, lost the opportunity for a raise because of these provisions that that were in contracts that they didn't sign. This is modeled after the no-poach agreement that we passed last year. And it just says that those two entities can't make restrictive employment provisions in their contracts. And if they have contracts that include this now, they have a year to either amend the contract or to write a memorandum, attach a memorandum, understanding that makes clear that the restrictions are null and void. This is an important bill to close a loophole to provide all Minnesota workers the protections of the ban on the non-compete and the no-poach agreement that we passed last year. And it's important to draw a clear line in Minnesota that these restrictive employment agreements are prohibited, and this would do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would I think we have a testifier list and some public testimony.
I've got a list of testifiers here. The first one on my list is Josh Musa-Cantow. I hope I didn't butcher that too badly, and please identify yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if you want to pull the microphone down, yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Josh Musa-Cantow. I've worked third shift at River Towers for 11 years, providing security, running the pool vacuum, monitoring the guest parking, and salting the entryways. When I started at River Towers, the building was managed by First Service Residential. When River Towers residents chose not to renew their contract with First Service last summer, they wanted to keep the employees of First Service working there on staff after replacing First Service. But First Service said they will enforce their restrictive covenant to prevent River Towers residents from retaining the staff they know and trust after replacing First Service with a different company. 48 First Service workers in the Twin Cities signed a petition calling on First Service to disclose which of their properties had similar restrictive covenants, but First Service still refuses to disclose this vital information. To fight for our jobs, my coworkers and I went to the local media with the story, distributed informational flyers, and kept trying to discuss the problems created by restrictive covenants with management. I personally confronted the vice president about it. Fortunately, After a difficult battle, we eventually succeeded with getting First Service to agree to at least allow staff members who didn't receive transfers to another First Service property to remain at River Towers like the residents wanted. But how many workers subject to these covenants in Minnesota have the means to wage a public pressure campaign? We were only in a position to fight in the way that we did because we were also in the middle of a unionization effort. No worker should have to go through what we went through. Minnesota got rid of non-competes. Now we need to finish the job by getting rid of these employer workarounds that cause a similar harm. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The next person I have on my list is Lev Roth, or Lev Roth. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Lev Roth, and I work for First Service Residential as a desk attendant in a high-rise condo. I handle resident requests, monitor building access, and let in emergency services. Last year, we successfully fought to get rid of non-compete clauses in our contracts, only to find out First Service Residential has covenants in their contracts with homeowners associations that restrict hiring any First Service Residential employee, either directly or indirectly, after the First Service contract with homeowners association ends. We employees have no say about the terms of these covenants, even though they directly affect our employment and our chances for advancement in the industry. In fact, we weren't even aware of these unfair restrictions until a member of the press told us last year. These restrictive covenants mean that when building switch management companies, they can't keep their experienced staff. In other words, loyal and hardworking staff could lose their jobs simply because First Service Residential has been replaced by the management as the management company. It also means any building that has switched companies in the past 2 years has to throw out resumes that list First Service Residential on it. I didn't even bother applying for a job I knew would mean a 25% wage increase and union benefits because it was at a high-rise that had ended its contract with First Service Residential, and the high-rise could face a lawsuit if I were to be hired. Working in the same industry should give workers an advantage in the hiring process, not make companies threaten their previous clients with lawsuits. These restrictive covenants are bad for workers, bad for anyone who signs a contract with one, and bad for the property services industry. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person on my list is Brian Shea. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Brian Shea. I worked 6 years for First Service Residential Minnesota, most of those years as the overnight desk attendant at Gallery Tower here in St. Paul. In April 2023, coworkers and I learned about First Service Residential's restricted covenants from an article in the American Prospect, not from our employer. Right. Wanting to know how many of us were affected, we organized a petition. There was a telling difficulty in collecting signatures, right? Talking to other workers, is that what we were describing made no sense to them. Right? It made no sense to people that there would be a restriction on their employment that they had never heard of and that they had never agreed to. It didn't make sense that these covenants could exist. And we couldn't point to them, right? Because we were not parties to these contracts. Despite that, eventually, 48 coworkers signed our petition asking management how many of us were affected by these covenants. All right, management did not answer. Another desk attendant, Josh, asked former First Service Minnesota Vice President about covenants at a neighborhood association meeting. Did not answer. A group of coworkers and I approached him at a company-sponsored event. Asked the same questions that remained unanswered, and again, refused to answer and left the event. If there's nothing dodgy about these covenants, why dodge the question? All right, if there's an appropriate condition of employment, why hide this from employees? This past December, the overnight shift at Gallery Tower was eliminated. I was laid off. Looking for work, I have no way of knowing whether or where these covenants restrict my employment. Right? Even if I did know, right, the existence of the covenant still limits employment opportunities, and it distorts the labor market. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person on my list is Michael Rubke. Again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Michael Rubke, and I'm a desk attendant at a condo managed by First Service. Since I work overnight, a big part of my job is to look after residents' safety and well-being by watching for potential intruders, granting quick access to medical teams when 911 is called, or even calling the repair and cleanup crews if a pipe bursts in the winter. Residents place a great deal of trust in me, and I really appreciate it, and I appreciate them. So when I think about the problem of restrictive covenants at First Service, I am, of course, concerned for my own job security, but I am also really feel for the residents who have to weigh potentially putting workers like me out of a job just because they want to choose a different property management company. We recently heard that at Bridgewater, another Minneapolis condo that First Service manages, many residents were very interested in switching to a different property management company this time the last time their contract was up. But when it came time to make the decision, Bridgewater stayed with First Service. Workers there heard from some residents that a big part of their decision to stay was because First Service restrictive covenant would not let them keep the same staff they relied on so much. It's important to remember that in most cases, the effects of restricted covenants are largely invisible from the outside, even though the effect is quite powerful. We don't really hear about all the contract changes that didn't happen, even though residents wanted to change. We don't see how much our pay as workers would be higher if companies actually had to compete to keep us and allow us to work for the employer of our choosing. That's why the Minnesota reformer called restrictive covenants shadow non-competes. And that's also why they should be banned. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Joe Pickett. And again, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Joe Pickett. I am the owner-operator of two early childhood centers, one in Maple Grove, one in Brooklyn Park. And I'm here to speak in opposition to HF 3456 from a perspective of a child care provider. First and foremost, you know, I would like to see the customer-business relationship to remain, you know, unintruded upon, and, you know, putting in place a restrictive agreements is not something that businesses do to restrict employee movement. Is done to protect their businesses, the investments that they make, and that they're trying to, you know, keep away from unscrupulous customers that might use their insight or inside information or inside track to our business to harm our business. Those are reasons that businesses in general put it. In childcare, it's particularly concerning, though, because we have a workforce crisis right now. And with the workforce crisis, a covenant or a removal of our non-solicitation from our customer agreements, our family agreements, could have some pretty devastating impacts on our industry. In general, our teachers, by design, build strong relationships with their parents. I mean, they're the caregivers of their children, and those parent-teacher relationships become very strong. And there are parents that would love to hire those teachers right into their household as a nanny so that they can have that child care right there at home, making it more convenient for them. The arrangements, you know, vary all over the board. They could be a nanny that gets paid straight cash, or some of these people might do it the right way and become employers. But whatever happens, there's a harm to the business. And it's not just to me as a business owner. There's a harm to my fellow, to our parents, you know, the parents that rely on the care of that caregiver. If we have a situation where we have to lose a teacher-qualified individual. And a teacher-qualified individual, by the way, is a state-mandated qualification that we have to have on staff to be able to care for children. And if we lose a teacher-qualified employee, and I can't replace them that quickly, and right now we can't, they're hard to find, I may be telling a half a dozen or more other parents that their child care is now lost until I can either replace that person or maybe just have to half my program. I did have to do that once last year. I lost two employees out of one program. It hit me hard and fast. They had to leave on a short notice, and I had to disenroll 10 kids. I mean, and those parents and families were devastated by that. It really hurt them. They were very loving of those teachers, but they were also left without many options to quickly find new child care. So I understand that, you know, our employees are free to move at any time. They can move around to different employers at will. And I compete hard against my competitors, who I know I'm competing with, to make sure my employees are well taken care of, and I work hard in retention. What I'm not watching is my backside, where my customers are possibly coming in and working out a side deal with somebody, and then they're going to take them, and it's going to harm our business and harm some of our additional families. So I'd like to trust my customers, but the real world is that there are some that will work to their own advantage, and they don't really care what it means to others in the center. So this particular bill, I think, is just bad for child care in particular because of what we're going to have to face once it becomes law. We do disclose to our employees that we have these non-solicitations. This is not a shadow non-compete. This is something that we tell our employees. It's in the handbook. We tell them up front. And I got to tell you, many of my employees are thankful to have it because they do get approached by that parent that they've built a strong relationship with, and that parent's starting to talk to them about, hey, would you be interested in being a nanny for our household? And they don't want to do that. They don't want to leave my employment. They don't want to go work for that family, but they're also in an awkward position to tell that parent that. So they then use this non-solicitation to say, I'm sorry, I can't go work for you because you can't hire me due to the agreement you have with Primrose. So it's not always a shadow agreement, and many times it's disclosed, and it's disclosed for the employee's benefit. The last thing I just want to remark on is the part, I think it's subdivision 3, where we're essentially going to have to go broadcast to our families that non-competes are no longer in play, or non-solicitations are no longer in play. That's going to be open season to my teachers. I mean, at that point, many families are going to be like, oh, well, then I think I will think about how I can hire off those teachers. And again, that's going to have a ripple effect on many other families in my center. So I would just, you know, if you have to look at where to go with this, a disclosure, I think, would be an appropriate thing, that if you have those with your customers, that you would disclose those to your employees. But please don't, you know, unlevel the playing field with me and my customers now and have, you know, some detrimental harm be brought on my business. So, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Wade Luneberg. And members, as he's coming down, there were some letters in the packet, testimony that was given to us. You want to read those? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape.
Wade Luneberg, Chair Nelson, committee members. In my day job, I'm the political director for Unite Here, Local 17. I was over here on some other business today and found out about the committee hearing, and I'm eager to testify today as a resident of the River Towers, where Josh has greeted me in and out of the parking garage and in and out of the front door for the past 10 years. The River Towers is, I believe, the largest HOA complex in the Twin Cities, with 350 units and 550 to 600 residents. It's a 50-year-old HOA since 1974, and I'm pleased to say I have a beautiful view over Gateway Park in Minneapolis, across the street from the Federal Reserve Bank and the Central Post Office. It's a wonderful place to live. Because of the age of the building, the age and size of the building, it also takes a lot to manage a building like that. And First Service was previously our management company, historically, I think, for decades. And in fact, the other thing I'll add is that many of the employees, up to 18 or 20 workers, many of them have decades of service there as well. Office staff, door and garage attendants, outdoor staff, engineers. It's a huge complex to manage, and because of the age, very complicated in running it. While I'm not a member of the board of the HOA, I'm an active resident and attend my HOA meetings. There's a point with First Service where our HOA, because of a number of projects that went south, we had a $5 million HVAC project that we ended up doing twice because the management of the project was not done right, including mediation, arbitration, subrogation. We also had a badly priced and executed hallway project, also by First Service, and also a $3 million parking ramp repair. After some of those bungled projects, the HOA decided to put out an RFP. And the RFP was ultimately won by another company. At that point, there was also a union organizing campaign that led to a majority of the workers saying they wanted to join a union to protect their rights on the job and to, I think, also out of concern for where First Service might be going after they lost the RFP. It's at that point that my HOA learned that we were not going to have access or the ability to ask any of those workers if they would like to actually stay with the River Towers HOA. It's fair to say that First Service actually leveraged the workers against the HOA, the customer, in demonstrating that they were going to lay off and fire and only relocate a number of the workers, and also not exercising the ability for us to actually keep any of the workers there after decades of service. Please, we're asking, as a customer here today, the HOA, to do the right thing for well-intended HOAs in trying to support their workers and to keep their workers and make it fair for workers in this process. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak on this bill? If not, we have some amendments here. I have the A1 amendment, and Representative Myers, is that your amendment?
Yes, it is, Chair.
And you want to explain what your amendment does? It seems pretty straightforward.
Yep, so I'm moving the A1 amendment. What it does is it just, I picked a service provider, one being childcare, to not be included in this. As I was thinking through this amendment, I think there's some unintended consequences for service providers. It could be disability services, but I went with childcare. It's something I'm dealing with right now. And, I just think we want to work to try to address some of the concerns we have in some of these industries. And so I would ask Representative Greenman to consider this amendment.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Myers, and appreciate the conversation we had about this on the floor. Members, today I'm going to ask you to vote against this amendment. I have been having good conversations with the Minnesota Child Care Association and others, and one of the pieces about these provisions is until we actually brought this bill and because of how these provisions work, we actually haven't heard a lot from workers who are impacted by them outside of the example you heard today, because many workers don't know that they exist. I think the conversation moving forward and talking to both childcare workers, childcare providers, one of the things I do want to say, because I think childcare is really important, and we have spent a lot of time talking about childcare, and it is like a place we talked about at the One Minnesota Conference. It is an industry and it is a model in crisis. It is a public good that deserves public support. And childcare workers deserve the same worker protections as other workers too. And so when I think about carving out childcare workers because of a workforce shortage, we have workforce shortages all over. And what we should be doing is saying, how can we support the model? Now, the one other thing I want to say is we've been doing that. Last session, we passed the Great Start compensation support and have been doing this as out of the pandemic. That has supported providers and centers and raise the wages, because we know that a piece of this, what we want to do is make sure that our childcare providers can provide the wages and the support that workers need and want to stay. With that, We know that that's kept, and we've actually heard from providers that that has actually helped folks stay alive and keep their workforce. So I would ask you to vote against this and vote against excluding child care workers from this provision. This will go to judiciary. So I think, what, as I said to you on the floor, we're going to continue talking about this and talking to all the stakeholders, but I'd ask for a no vote today.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Greenman. You know, I do want to thank all the testifiers for coming. It's, you know, initially I was trying to better understand where these situations could occur. You know, I understand these situations, but I can also see in some of the other service-related areas. You know, the consideration, and you brought it up, was, you know, how important, you know, the child care industry is. I have a three-year-old. You know, we use it. We know how important it is. We know how disruptive it can be. We can, you know, I think we can all understand that there needs to be a balance there. I guess I'm having a tough time understanding, knowing the investments that were made last session, to then, you know, what you call, you know, close a loophole. I would maybe say probably goes one step further, that may start impacting, you know, again, this service industry of childcare in a negative way. So I would ask members to, you know, support this amendment.
Representative Jordan, you had a question.
I did, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Paquette, if he is still around.
Welcome back. And Representative Jordan.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Paquette. I just have, I've also heard quite a bit from my constituents who both are in need of childcare, but also a lot of my constituents are employed in providing childcare. So I have some just questions about the industry.
Sure.
And how this bill would go specifically. And so I guess what you answered one of my questions actually in your testimony, which is, are your workers made aware of these provisions when they start working for your childcare centers? Is that an industry standard, and do you know how many child care, is that a common practice in child care centers, or is that just something you do as a good employer?
Mr. Paquette.
I can't speak to that specific issue or question for other employers, but the ones that I'm intimately familiar with, I do know we try to be upfront with our employees, and it is kind of a business protection tactic as much as anything else, because if we can let our employees know about these agreements, like I said, it gives them kind of a out of that discussion if they want to get out of that discussion. And many of them do. They're not, they don't want to go to somebody's house to work. They enjoy and want to work for us as child care employers. But if they don't know about the agreement, they can't use it as a tool. And then they're stuck in an awkward conversation in many cases.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then do you have an example of what that handbook language looks like that you could share with the committee?
Yeah, I can provide my handbook for you.
Great.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel for whoever that our first testifier was who struggles with that, I struggle with it too.
We all, I guess, like I said, even longtime members sometimes have trouble with that. But Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I have some, what I hear from both providers and workers in my district is that they aren't necessarily leaving to be like a nanny. They're leaving to work at big box stores or fast food restaurants. Or actually they're going to Minneapolis public schools, which I'm very proud that we've worked to better fund our public schools. And that's where people are going, not necessarily working as a private nanny per se. So do you know, is that consistent with what you're hearing, or are you, I mean, you must not be because you have one of these agreements in your handbook, but for the industry as a whole, where are employees turning over and going to work? Is it as nannies, or is it working in other sectors, or is it working in other child care providers?
Mr. Paquette.
It's all of the above. That when they're leaving and leaving the industry, some of them are leaving to do new career choices. Some of them are going to my competitors who are giving them a better option than what I'm able to offer them. But for the most part, they're leaving because they just are looking for maybe a change. They've been doing child care for a long time in some cases, or some of them have just started and they've decided it's not the field they want to be in. So, but just to be clear, we only have the non-solicitation with our customers, not with any of our vendors or anybody else that I do business with. It's just our families, because I know that relationship that they're building with that teacher is going to be a strong one, and that's the one that I don't want to have to worry about, where that family's kind of undermining our business and our other families.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So nothing about this would actually prevent, and maybe this is a better question for Representative Greenman. And then I do have one more question for you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
But so would Representative Greenman, I guess, to this point, would anything in this prevent a child care worker from going to go work at a Subway?
Representative Greenman.
No. And I think that would be a probably a violation of a set of laws in terms of competition laws.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, one question for you, Mr. Paquette. Do you know what the turnover rate is, either in your facilities or in the industry as a whole in Minnesota? Like, what is the exact turnover rate that we're seeing from employees in the child care sector?
Mr. Paquette.
Yes, I calculated it for both of mine for 2023. One center had a 30% turnover rate, and another one had a 70% turnover rate.
Ooh. Any further? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paquette, in your contract that you have your employees sign, if they do go to work somewhere else, which of course is a free country, we have all our freedoms, you're fine with that, obviously, because we're not, you know, that's America. But you have in there in your clause that it's a cost, because it costs you to train the employee. So can you share with some of those numbers with the committee as to what it costs you to train a good employee, and then 2-3 months after they're trained and they're really good, boom, they're gone, you're out some money, then you have to find another employee. And what is the charge then, or the kind of the fee that you and your employees mutually agree to?
Mm-hmm. Mr.
So,
Paquette.
Yeah.
Customers, yes.
The customers, right now I have a straight non-solicitation, so they just aren't soliciting. There's no provision for a penalty in my contracts. I know other child care providers, other businesses have a payment or a fee that they charge for it to try to recoup some of their costs. Right now I have not put that in my contracts for non-solicitation with my customers, but there is a cost. I mean, right now there's a lot of teachers that I've implemented my own program for growing these teachers, giving them CDAs, which gives them the credentials to be teacher qualified. And that's probably about a $4,000 to $5,000 investment that I'm making, because I'm paying them to do video training without getting any benefit from their services at that time. But then I'm also, getting them all the way through that CDA process, paying for their education. We do pay for higher education for some others that are seeking like an associate's or even a bachelor's degree. So there are investments. And currently, and some people would think I'm not being very smart about this, but I don't even have a recoup agreement with my employees to get that back if they were to leave. So I'm out that investment, at least in my centers, whether they stay with me for, only a month, 2 months, 6 months. I'm probably not recouping that investment probably for a couple years.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald, we've got three more amendments, so if we can get moving through these, then otherwise we're going to run out of time today.
Yeah, I'm fully aware. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for reminding me. So then just quickly, and you certainly don't have to take much time because we're pressed for it, I guess. Your customers then, in your contract with your customers, you would be able to recoup that cost from your customers. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mr. Paquette.
Sorry.
Okay.
I heard Dory. The recoup would be, I would have to probably retain counsel to then sue those parents for violating that non-solicitation, and damages would probably have to be assumed because I don't have a repayment amount in my non-solicitation agreement.
Representative Myers?
Yep. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. We've just seen a lot of closures of child care facilities over the past 10 years. We know capacity is low. I can't remember the larger business ended up just not providing it for employees anymore. And I think what we want to do is try to make sure that we have owners and operators that want to invest in this industry. And that's why I brought this forward, because I do believe that this is going to restrict that. And I think we need to look at opportunities to improve on that.
Seeing no further questions, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The nays have it. The next amendment I have is the A2 amendment. And somebody going to offer that? Or
Mr. Chair?
Representative McDonald.
You'll be happy to know that due to time and the fact that it reiterates, we're drawing the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment has been withdrawn. The next one I have here is an A3 amendment. And is that Representative McDonald, that's listed as your amendment?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So the A3 amendment deletes everything after the provider on page 1, line 10. Insert a period after provider. And the reason for that, Mr. Chair, and the concern that we have, Representative Greenman, is that under your bill, it defines it as an employee, but yet the concern is regarding independent contractors. So independent contractors is not really, this would bill could affect them. And it's not about, of course, independent contractors, it's about employees. And in your bill, it would be in incongruent with state statute 181.931, subsection 2, that defines what a subcontractor is and not an employee. So that is the concern that we have. I think many independent contractors are just concerned that this would loop in together an employee and a subcontractor, and we're not yet ready to change the state statute regarding independent contractors. And with that, I ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald. And this gives me an opportunity to clarify what this bill does, because this language is already in statute. This doesn't change at all either the four employment tests we have or the relationship between how you determine whether someone's an employee and an independent contractor. What it does is say, and we use this language in both the non-competes and similar language in the no poach, what it says is this applies whether you are, as if you're a worker, whether you are an employee or an independent contractor. As folks who are following this, and I think we will have lots more discussion about this, about how you define an employee, it's actually quite complicated. There's depends on what test you're using, in what area. This does not touch any of that. What this says is this provision for this statute applies to both whether you are an independent contractor or an employee. And Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a no vote.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Greenman, for giving the intent of your bill, but nevertheless, by including both the independent contractor and the employee together, setting in state statute sets a precedent that is, in my opinion, as a independent contractor and knowing many, I'm sure all of us have friends and family that are independent contractors, this is a slippery slope. I say that very carefully because we say that too flippantly around here. But it does envelope those two together in state law, and I think that could be, I think many people could think that could be harmful to the independent contractor state statute law that we have now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
So I don't agree with you, but if there was a precedent to be set, this is already in statute, these two provisions. And so because they were in the non-compete and the no poach, and I think that we might have taken them for someone else. So this language is not breaking any new ground.
Representative McDonald?
Just lastly, Representative Greenman, that's good. We can certainly disagree, and sometimes we agree. That's the beauty of this legislature. But I think in tying those two together, it indicates into your bill, if it should become law, that an independent contractor is than an employee, and it negates the independent contractor state statute, and that's my high-level feel of that.
And with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson?
No.
Vice Chair Berg?
No.
Lead McDonald?
Yes.
Representative Daniels?
Yes.
Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Hill?
No.
Representative Hussein?
No.
Representative Jordan?
Jordan, no.
Representative Kozlowski is excused. Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Representative Myers?
Aye.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Representative Wolgamont?
No.
There are 5 ayes and 7 noes.
5 ayes and 7 noes, the amendment is not adopted. The next amendment I have here is the A4 amendment. And do we know who's offering that?
Yeah, I'll move the A4 amendment. What this does is just limits employers under 16. This goes to address some of those workforce challenges we're seeing, investments by owners and operators. and I would be hopeful that Representative Greenman would accept this.
Representative Greenman.
Hope springs eternal. I appreciate your, and again, I appreciate the conversation we're going to have. I would ask members to reject this vote, this amendment. Like the no poach and the non-compete, we don't have an employer, a size of the employment. This is about the rights of workers and the workers that in many cases don't know or are not compelled to know that these exist. And so whether you're a worker who works for a business of 10 or a business of 100, it affects you the same way. And so I'd ask members to reject this amendment. Vote no, please.
Representative Myers, any further discussion? If not, the clerk will take the roll. But, oh, there wasn't a roll call. All those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The noes have it. The amendment is not adopted. With that, any final closing words, Representative Greenman?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Myers.
Do we have opportunity for discussion on this bill before we go to the final closing comments?
We've got a few minutes, yes.
All right.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenman. And to, by the way, thank you to our testifiers as well. We really appreciate hearing from you, and I'm glad to hear that we had a number of perspectives on this bill brought before us today. One of the questions here is as I understand the bill, and I Representative Greenman is definitely a legal expert in the room, but my understanding of this bill is it's going to cause some constitutional challenges for us. And constitutional challenges along the lines of kind of revoking past agreements that are in place. That's my understanding of the way that the bill is written. And so can Representative Greenman, can you provide for us, does this legislation, does it invalidate like retroactively agreements that are in place currently?
Representative Greenman.
What this agreement does is says when this bill is passed, just those restrictive covenants are null and void. And it then says either you can amend your contract to reflect that, or you can attach a memorandum to reflect that. What I will say is, like we have seen in the no poach agreements, in many cases when these kinds of agreements go to court, a court finds them unenforceable and will determine them null and void. So that is actually not an uncommon thing. In the no poach context, part of the reason that many states have passed that bill is because when the Attorney General in Washington brought litigation, they were losing, and so a lot of the franchisers changed their policy. And so it is not, I'm not concerned about the constitutional challenge once we make this enforceable going forward, that you can't enforce this provision in the contract.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, so I am going to kindly disagree with you on that piece of the language, and that we should instead, and I'd ask the author to consider changes to this bill for future contracts. And I say that because we burned a hole in the sky, and there's no more surplus, which means we as a state don't have the money to be going to court to be working on a piece of legislation that we should be fixing in this room. The kids that go to school 2 years from now need the money to be in our state coffers rather than in court defining exactly where this legislation should be. So I highly encourage that we make that change. We don't have a budget surplus anymore. It does not exist. And so we need to ensure that we're not spending our tax dollars in court fighting lawsuits that may come from the constitutional challenges of this bill.
Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Would Rep. Greenman yield for a question?
Of course.
Representative Myers.
We heard from a child care provider that said the way that that business does it is providing full disclosure to employees. And I'm just wondering, trying to find an option, if you would be willing to
accept an option where there was full disclosure by a customer and a service provider about terms that would impact an employee.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, and this may be a conversation as this bill goes to judiciary, we can continue having. The secrecy of it is one thing, and we heard from testifiers who didn't even know until the reporter called them. We don't know how broad this practice is because there's no requirement of disclosure, except for the two people signing the contract. But that being said, I don't think that disclosure alone solves the problem for the worker, because if the worker doesn't want to be bound by this, they're not a party to this contract and they've never signed it. And so I think we could talk about, and I think that the lack of transparency, the shadow piece is a part of this, but there is also the binding a worker, restricting their ability to go or find a new position or in some cases stay with the place that they've been for a while. That doesn't solve that problem. So I think as we think about working on this forward, that is the piece that I'm really thinking about is how this impacts workers. And in many cases, all the workers we heard talked about today are workers in relatively low wage, high turnover industries. And so protecting those folks and their ability to avoid some of the negative consequences we've seen in terms of wage depression is important. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. I'm just, you know, again, you know, new member here trying to find less aggressive ways to accomplish what you're doing. And I think looking at those disclosures related to employees could be a potential. And so I'm hopeful that you're willing to have those conversations, not only with me, but people in disability services, childcare. I think there's a lot of industries that could be impacted by this. So thank you.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Greenman, you want to wrap up quickly?
Thank you, and I really appreciate the discussion. I really appreciate all the testifiers. We make our best policy rooted in people's experiences and stories, and I would just ground us back in what this bill does, which is last year we prohibited non-competes. We prohibited employers from putting restrictions on their employees. What this does is close a loophole that says that two entities can contract in a way that will restrict that third party who's not a party to that contract, who in this case happens to be a worker, and it can restrict theirs. That's what this does. And so with that, members, I'd ask you to vote yes to send it on to judiciary. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative McDonald has asked for a roll call, so there'll be a roll call. And Representative Greenman renews her motion that House File 3456 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
No.
No.
Oh, yes. Excuse me. Yes. I thought I'm up.
It's a surprise.
No, you're right. We're on the bill. Not the I vote yes.
Chair Nelson votes aye. Vice.
It's our first meeting.
Vice Chair Berg.
Yes.
Vice Chair Berg votes aye. Lead McDonald.
No.
Lead McDonald votes no. Representative Daniels.
No.
Representative Daniels votes no. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman votes aye. Representative Hill.
Yes.
Representative Hill votes aye. Representative Hussein.
Aye.
Representative Hussein votes aye. Representative Jordan.
Jordan aye.
Representative Jordan votes aye. Representative Kozlowski is excused. Representative Meckland.
No.
Representative Meckland votes no. Representative Myers.
Nay.
Representative Myers votes nay. Representative Schultz.
No.
Representative Schultz votes no. Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
Representative Wolgamott votes aye. There are 7 ayes and 5 nays.
With 7 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is referred to the Judiciary Finance Committee. And thank you, members. And
thank you, Chair.
Again, as you can tell, this is our first meeting back after the break. And so with that, members, no, nothing further?
No.
Nothing further. We are adjourned.